Unitarian Universalism draws from six diverse sources, and our fourth source explicitly references the Jewish and Christian teachings, acknowledging the liberal Christian roots of both Unitarianism and Universalism, which merged in 1961 to the Unitarian Universalism that we know today. And I would like to reflect some this morning on the tensions that are inherently underneath that fourth source, in particular, the competing directions and how those two traditions approach the shared text that Jews call the Tanakh and that Christians call the Old Testament. On many Fridays and Saturdays, the Reform Jewish congregation Kol Ami worships right here in this sanctuary. And if you ask Rabbi Dan for a copy of a Jewish Bible, you'll see that, of course, that Jewish Bible does not include the Christian New Testament. And the books are in a slightly different order, such as, for example, it doesn't end with Malachi, it ends with 2 Chronicles, but the books are basically the same material. And although both Jews and Christians share that same Hebrew scripture, there are ways in which the Christian tradition in general and the presence of the New Testament in particular shape how Christians often interpret the Hebrew Bible, even though Jews and Christians are reading the exact same text. Imagine that instead of being here on a UU service for Sunday mornings, you were actually here in the sanctuary 24 hours earlier for one of Kol Ami's Saturday morning services. And a young woman who is becoming a bat mitzvah, a daughter of the covenant, ascends the steps to the bima, this platform, and reads the Haftorah portion, the part of the prophetic books as opposed to the other reading from the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. She would read it in Hebrew and then translate it into English. So hear now this reading from the 9th chapter of the prophet Isaiah. There will be no gloom for those who were in anguish. In the former time, he brought into contempt the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the latter time, he will make glorious the way of the sea, the land beyond the Jordan, the Galilee of the nations. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who lived in a land of deep darkness, on them a light has shined. You have multiplied the nations, increased its joy. They rejoice before you as joy at the harvest, as people exult when dividing plunder. For the yoke of their burden and the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, you have broken as on the day of Midian. For all the boots of the tramping warriors and all the garments rolled in blood shall be burned as fuel for the fire. For a child has been born to us, a son given to us, and authority rests upon his shoulders. And his name is called, some of you may hear Handel's Messiah start echoing, Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. His authority shall grow continually, and there shall be endless peace for the throne of David and his kingdom. He will establish and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time onward and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Now, how might hearing those words from the prophet Isaiah on a Saturday morning as part of a Jewish congregation be different than hearing those exact same words read on a Sunday morning as part of a Christian congregation? And how might that different setting affect the direction in which that same text is interpreted? To explore these questions, I invite you to imagine something different. Imagine now that you are in the 8th century BCE, more than 2,700 years ago. You're in the ancient Near East, in the southern kingdom of Judah. You're part of the political elite, in the inner circle of the king, who is a descendant of the house of David. And today you are hearing Isaiah of Jerusalem deliver a new prophetic oracle, one of the many passionate presentations that he has made to the royal court in recent years. At this point, there is no book of Isaiah. He's not dictating, thinking that there's going to be some future collection of what he said. You're hearing these words for the first time as they are being delivered live. You would catch all of Isaiah's poetic allusions. You're familiar with the intense pressure on your king, the king of Judah, to get involved with the recent Syro-Ephraimite crisis. When King Tiglath-Pileser III, who we affectionately refer to as TP3, when he invaded the territory of King Pekah of Israel, and Pekah, along with King Rezin of Syria, wanted your king to get involved with that skirmish. Syria, think about, is the modern-day Iraq, and you can see parallels for the way that our own President Obama is being called to get involved and feels pressure to get involved in Syria, the same country, in Iraq, in other troubled regions. Turning back to the past, you have heard the prophet Isaiah address this political crisis many times. Isaiah is loyal to the kings of Judah, who are descendants of David, and he has been involved with lobbying the king to trust in divine protection. You know, listen to me, not to your military leaders. You know, Obama has to wrestle with the same thing, right? Who in his cabinet does he listen to? Isaiah has been a strong advocate of non-interventionist, isolationist policy, and urging the king to rely on God and not become entangled in political alliances with the king of Israel and Syria against Assyria's TP3, Tiglath-Pileser III. Assyria is the great regional power at this time, and the verses we heard read earlier were from Isaiah chapter 9, and the first 12 chapters of the book of Isaiah consist of Isaiah's prophetic speeches from the time of the Syro-Ephraimite War and the corresponding reign of King Hezekiah of Judah. As an important figure in Judah's royal court, you would have heard Isaiah deliver all of those oracles live and in person as he attempted to influence the nation's defense policy. You would have known that Isaiah's references to Zebulun and Naphtali that sound so foreign to us today, those were the ancient tribal names of the areas that Assyria had recently captured. You would have recognized the Way of the Sea as an allusion to the region south of Mount Carmel, and the land beyond the Jordan as the regional coast of Galilee. Both of those areas had been recently captured by Assyria as well. Likewise, the name of Tiglath-Pileser III of Assyria, King Pekah of Israel, King Hezekiah of Judah, King Rezin of Syria, those would have been as familiar to you today, to the political elites in Isaiah's audience 2,700 years ago in the inner court of the king, as leaders in that region are to us today from the headlines, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, President Bashar al-Assad of Syria, former Prime Minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki. Those names that are familiar to us today, those ancient names would have been equally as familiar. And Isaiah's references to all those intricacies of the Syro-Ephraimite crisis between Syria, Israel, Assyria, and Judah would have been like references we hear today to 9/11, to ISIS, to Syria and Iraq. The Syro-Ephraimite War and the surrounding political pressures and diplomacy were the defining geopolitical events of that day. And these events were part of the text and subtext of the speeches given by the political religious leaders at that time. Isaiah didn't know that his words would be edited and collected and come to be called Holy Scripture by a later people. He certainly didn't know that there would someday be another anthology of books called the New Testament that would again reappropriate and recontextualize his words. Isaiah was simply speaking as a Jew about the political situation in his day in the 8th century BCE to influence the immediate decision-making of the political elites. Isaiah's original purpose was to celebrate the birth of a new crown prince who had been born not long after the height of that Syro-Ephraimite crisis in the 8th century. This new crown prince was another descendant of David and brought with him all the hopes that have always been associated with David's line. So with Saul and David and Solomon around the year 1000 BC, there was the united monarchy. But then it got split into the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah. Assyria came to destroy the northern kingdom of Israel over time. Babylon then came to power and took Judah into exile. So the hope in the Davidic line was the hope that this new crown prince would grow up to reunite the kingdoms of Judah and Israel, to reclaim the lands recently lost to Assyria, and reinstitute the golden age of the United Kingdom of Israel as it had been under David 250 years earlier. That was the hope with which Isaiah sought to inspire the political elite of Judah 2,700 years ago. Hope in the face of fears of a warmongering king of Assyria and the resulting political pressures from the neighboring Syria and Israel. You need to come help us But Isaiah knew that coming to the help of Israel and Syria meant that that would put them even more in the crosshairs of TP3. So he was seeking to speak hope in the future leadership of a newborn crown prince born 700 years before Jesus of Nazareth ever came onto the scene.
A reading from the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. Now when Jesus heard that John had been arrested, he withdrew into Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, he went and dwelt in Capernaum by the sea, in the territory of Zebulun and Naphtali, so that what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, toward the sea, across the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. And for those who sat in the region of the shadow of death, light has dawned.
Having learned more about the original context of Isaiah, I'm curious to hear, maybe how did you hear that gospel lesson differently than you might have otherwise, as well as that corresponding bass air and recitative from Handel. Who were those people that walked in darkness, and when did they see a great light, and what was the light? Was the light Jesus in the first century, and was the darkness Rome? Or was the darkness the Syro-Ephraimite crisis and the light the newborn crown prince? The conservative Christian tradition of my childhood taught me that Isaiah was basically the fifth evangelist, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Isaiah. And when a gospel writer quoted a passage from the Hebrew prophets, that I should think, isn't it amazing how that ancient prophecy predicted details about Jesus' ministry? But the more I explore the original context of the Hebrew prophets, the more I think that Isaiah would have been dumbfounded by Matthew's interpretation of his words. In Isaiah's understanding, the fruit of his prophetic speech was borne out in his lifetime. Isaiah told the reigning king of Judah that he should place his hope in God and in the future descendants of David, specifically the newborn crown prince. But Hezekiah chose to ignore Isaiah's warning and instead attacked Assyria. He was, if you were wondering, spectacularly unsuccessful. The Assyrian counterattack ravaged Judah and besieged the capital of Jerusalem. I can imagine Isaiah saying, we have no record of this, but something along the lines of, "Thus saith the Lord, I told you so." Isaiah spoke a prophetic word, the king ignored it, so from Isaiah's perspective, the shelf life of his prophetic speech had expired. Isaiah would be shocked if he somehow found out that someone had applied his prophetic speech to a situation 800 years after his death. So what is Matthew doing? Matthew says that Jesus, quote, left Nazareth and made his home in Capernaum so that what had been spoken through the prophet Isaiah might be fulfilled. He then quotes the first two verses of Isaiah chapter 9 about how the gloomy and anguished Zebulun, Naphtali, and Galilee, that there will be a great light for those who have lived in a land of deep darkness. Matthew's leaders would have known that Nazareth, which he has Jesus leaving, was part of what used to be called the tribal territory of Zebulun, and Capernaum, where he was said to be going, belonged to what was known as the land of the Naphtali tribe. And that both Nazareth and Capernaum were in the Galilee of the Gentiles. But this raises the question of whether Jesus decided to leave Nazareth and go to Capernaum in obedience to this prophecy from Isaiah. And I increasingly think that Jesus did not consult Isaiah as a playbook in quite that way. Nevertheless, it is important to emphasize that Matthew wasn't stupid, nor did he think that the intended audience for his gospel was ignorant. Instead, Matthew is extending a trajectory of scriptural interpretation that was already well established. Even though Isaiah was only speaking to his immediate context, later Jewish interpreters, between Isaiah's time and between Matthew's time and those centuries in between, had often applied Isaiah's words to the Jewish kings in their own day, who faced similar situations to that of Hezekiah in the 8th century. Later Jewish interpreters even applied Isaiah's words to the expected Messiah, though that was understood in different ways. So when Matthew applied Isaiah's words to Jesus, he was continuing a direction of interpretation that was already in place of reading backward from one's own context and interpreting the words of long-ago prophets as applicable to one's own present-day experience, irrespective of the original author's intention. Matthew was unconcerned with Isaiah's original intention. In Matthew's day, there was no New Testament. He wasn't submitting to the New Testament board for publication. And then, in the first century, what we call the Hebrew Scriptures was only two-thirds complete. So when Jesus references the Jewish Scriptures, he talks about the Law and the Prophets, the Torah and the Prophets. He doesn't talk about the Tanakh, because a whole third of the Hebrew Bible was still not complete for about 200 years after Jesus' death. If pressed, Matthew, as well as other similar interpreters, might have said that this way of reading meaning backward into the Hebrew Scriptures, that it actually exposed a deeper meaning of the Scriptures that had always been there, even if the original authors didn't realize that it was there. It was there, and now you know, because Matthew has written his book. Even though it had nothing to do, again, with what the original author thought he or she was saying. So one could argue that this is one among many possible legitimate ways of reading Scripture. But when this particular way of reading the Hebrew Bible is multiplied again and again over the last 2,000 years by Christians, you can begin to sympathize with the Jewish complaint that in regard to the Christian use of the Hebrew Bible, Christianity stole our watch and for the last 2,000 years has been trying to tell us what time it is. And when this direction of interpretation is continued, especially without close examination of the dynamic that's going on, the result is Christian appropriation of Jewish scriptures and traditions without any reciprocity and without any accountability. So how do we read and approach the Bible more responsibly in light of this awareness, especially after the Holocaust? And a greater awareness of the ways Christianity has contributed to anti-Judaism through the centuries. To begin to respond to that question, I want to return to some of the differences in translation that you may have noticed between the Jewish translation of Isaiah 9 and the translations you may be more accustomed to hearing. The most recognizable differences are not in the first two verses of Isaiah chapter 9, which is what Matthew quotes, but verse 5, which is never quoted anywhere in the Christian New Testament. It was instead made famous 1,700 years after the New Testament by George Friedrich Handel in The Messiah. He shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, as the choir belts out in The Messiah. A much better translation of that verse. So it turns out Handel wasn't that great at Hebrew. And when you look at like the Jewish Publication Society of those verses, they translate it this way. The mighty God is planning grace, the eternal Father, a peaceable ruler. Jews are monotheists who have studied their scriptures closely, and it's unreasonable to assume that the Jewish people failed to notice that Isaiah's prediction was that the human Messiah would be called the Mighty God, because that would be a problem if you're a monotheist, right? Having a Messiah that's human and called the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. And what Isaiah is actually describing, and which you see in the much better translation of the Hebrew by the Jewish Publication Society, is that Isaiah is talking about the throne name of that 8th century crown prince. That young child was given a name that means the mighty God is planning grace through this child. The eternal Father is hope for a peaceable ruler. And that throne name is a symbolic way of describing the kind of king that crown prince was hoped to be in the Davidic line, as well as the kind of God that king was thought to represent. Matthew, however, was not concerned with the 8th century BCE. He was concerned with the 1st century. He was concerned with using Isaiah's words to support Matthew's understanding of Jesus. But what about us? In what direction should we read the Bible? I invite you to ask, When you read the Bible or other scriptures, does your interpretation lead you backward to the Hebrew scriptures? Does it lead you forward to other parts of the Christian tradition? Does it lead you sideways out of yourself to connect and care for your neighbors? Does it lead you downward to connecting and helping the poor? And whatever scripture you're reading, whether Jewish or Christian, Buddhist or Hindu, or the latest issue of the journal Science, if that is scripture for you, my hope is that you will be attentive to the undercurrents of your interpretation, where your interpretations lead you. One of my favorite guides for interpreting scripture comes from the Yale New Testament scholar Dale Martin, who argues in his book, The Pedagogy of the Bible, that we citizens of the 21st century must own that we know too much now, and we must own our responsibility for the truth, the goodness, the morality, and the social effect of how we interpret the Bible or any other text, sacred or secular. People throughout history have used the Bible and other scriptures to affirm and to argue for and support slavery as well as emancipation, to support sexism as well as equality. The same text, violence and nonviolence. And if your interpretation leads to more violence, oppression, and inequality in this world instead of more liberation, justice, and peace, then reader response critics such as Martin invite you to consider that the responsibility is much more on you, the individual interpreter, or much more on why have you chosen to be part of an interpretive community that teaches you to read scripture or to read texts in a way that increase violence and inequality and oppression. You could similarly say that it is illegitimate for anyone to blame the Bible, the Quran, or any sacred book for their hate, their apathy, and their vengefulness, just as it is illegitimate to blame racism, sexism, heterosexism, or any other oppression on Scripture. We know too much in the 20th century. We know too much to let ourselves off the hook that easily or to let other people off the hook. If your interpretations do not lead to more love, compassion, forgiveness, mercy, and grace in this world, what Paul called the fruit of the Spirit, that if we're acting with the Spirit, what we call the Spirit of life, then that leads to love, to joy, to peace, to patience, to kindness, to goodness, to faithfulness, and self-control. That's how you know that you're manifesting the Spirit of life in your reading of texts and in the world. And if that's not the case, then your interpretation is irresponsible and should be denounced. We all pick and choose, liberals and conservatives. And if you pick and choose, why not choose love? In the words of William Sloane Coffin, the world is too dangerous for anything but truth and too small for anything but love. And I'm grateful to be with you in this tradition of Unitarian Universalism in which we seek together to stand on the side of love. Now, we don't always get it right. You know, we seek to build a diverse, beloved community, drawing from six sources, and sometimes we have conflict. Sometimes we don't always get along. But then we have to choose again to stand on the side of love, of telling the truth, speaking the truth in love, and choosing forgiveness and reconciliation.